Dublab. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hello, could I please speak with Holly Herndon?
This is she.
Hello, Holly. This is Paul Holdengraber calling you from The Quarantine Tapes. I'm really so delighted you could take the time to speak to us. Let me ask you at the outset, where do I find you and how have you been living these last, let us say, 5 months?
I live in Berlin, Germany, and I have actually felt rather fortunate to be here because I have a home studio. So my daily life is often kind of quarantined as it is, but I'm safely quarantined in Berlin where I have my home studio, and I'm able to continue to work.
You said something that's so interesting. You said, I think music plays a really big part in creating a vision or momentum towards human development. Can you say a little bit more about this, and what is this vision and this momentum?
I mean, music has always played a role in historically in human development, in our kind of the creation of culture, the formation of our brain, the formation of our societies, early hunting techniques. You know, it's this kind of embodied choreography that evolved kind of naturally out of our species. So it's musicking is a very old kind of technology that's very embedded in our humanity. But in terms of where we're going,
yeah, that's exactly it.
For me, sound travels really quickly. It always has traveled faster than a visual for me. And if I can't kind of hear the sound of the future or hear something that sounds like at least today, then I feel like I'm in a kind of like feedback loop or a kind of nostalgic cul-de-sac where I can't find a way forward. So for me, I feel like I have to hear at least the sound of today in order to imagine what a kind of tomorrow could be like. So that's why in a lot of ways I try to come up with a new sound world for the work that I do.
Do you fight nostalgia?
Many different people. And I never try to be prescriptive in that, you know, my practice is my practice. I don't think that it applies to everyone else. I don't judge other people for working with nostalgia. I understand it. I also find comfort in it sometimes. But for me, I feel like there is a kind of battle going on where I'm trying to find the sound of today. And if I rely, and of course that's made up of sounds from the past. It's not like everything's being reinvented from zero all the time, but that requires a kind of like break in a pattern. And those breaks can often feel wrong, or they can kind of like sound off, but we have to kind of try to make those breaks in order to come up with new possibilities. I guess that's what I'm trying to do.
Holly, you've tailored some of your lectures and performances to the exact audience in a room. I'm wondering, never having experienced this, how does that work, and do you see it as a means of resistance?
I don't know if it's a means of resistance. I feel like that's such particular language. I mean, I haven't done this in a long time, but I'm thinking back to when I have done this in the past. I think what I was dealing with at the time is I was trying to come to terms with the fact that my instrument is a computer and it's really good at playing back pre-composed or pre-arranged kind of works. And so I was trying to find a way for my instrument and myself to be in the present with the audience, and to show that we were sharing the same time and space, that it wasn't something that could just be kind of canned or automated, that there was like a human exchange happening in that room. And so I think that's why I was trying to tailor things specifically to the audience, just to highlight that shared moment.
But it seems like you're confronting people in what one might call a visceral way with what we often don't want to think about.
I don't know if I'm confronting.
I love your laugh here. Tell me.
Well, I don't know if I'm confronting people with things that they don't want to think about. I don't ever really think about it as confrontational in that way. I mean, confrontation means something different to everyone. I came up through a kind of noise community, and that's a specific kind of genre of music that's very much about confrontation. In fact, that's kind of the point of the music, is to create the most confrontational performance that you can make. And while that's not what I do anymore, my idea maybe of what's confrontational and what's not is maybe different from the average audience. I think I'm just trying to communicate in a way and just show that there's a presence there. I mean, there was a thing that we were doing for a while when I was touring with Platform, and we would sometimes kind of spy on people's Facebook.
Right, yeah, right. Fascinating. I read all about that. Really disturbing and fascinating. And something we don't want to think about, that we're being spied in this way. But in a way, we all know that we are.
Well, I was trying to show both like the beauty and the horror of it. Like, on the one side, the horror side, it's showing that, you know, by clicking on an event and showing that you're going to a Facebook event, that's public. Even though Facebook feels like this private, intimate space, it's not. It's publicly owned. All of your data, all of the kind of negatives around that. And so by highlighting and kind of spying on people's sites and maybe even bringing in pictures, I kind of highlighted the fact that none of that is really private or intimate space. But at the same time, we would also see things like, oh, so-and-so from the audience got a job today, or it's so-and-so's birthday. And then we were also able to kind of celebrate those intimate moments with the audience members together. And that would sometimes be a fun moment for people in the audience. So I was trying to show that these technologies aren't necessarily, you know, this kind of evil good narrative doesn't really work. They're both empowering and disempowering. It's all in the way that they're kind of being used.
You know, it reminds me of a wonderful line in Rabelais, a 16th century French writer, who said, "Science without conscience is but the ruin of the soul."
Yeah, and now we get to try to figure out what it means to have a conscience.
Good luck, right? We're trying, and I think in a way, as I prepare to speak with you, I think that's what you are attempting to do. You've said that surveillance is made purposefully opaque. If that is really the case, how can it be clarified?
That's a good question. I mean, I think some of the interventions that I've tried to do, I've tried to make topics that are sometimes, like you said, things that people don't want to think about,
right,
or kind of darker topics. I try to make them engaging in a way. But yeah, I mean, I don't know, it takes kind of a large scale public education project, really. And in a way, it takes an alternative kind of fantasy.
That is beautiful. That is beautiful. Say something about that. An alternative fantasy.
If we think about all of the kind of like beauty and opportunities that the internet allowed, that seems like, wow, that's this amazing gift. And it is. It's true. The internet's amazing. But we can also have another vision of the internet, one that's not necessarily relying on ad revenues for most of its, you know, interactions. And that could be an alternative vision of how our, you know, networked interactions could function. But I think sometimes it's really difficult to come up with a kind of collective alternative fantasy. if we can't even really see what the problem is, because, you know, as you said, the problem is somewhat opaque. I think a lot of people don't think about these somewhat maybe boring infrastructural issues. So I try to kind of bring them to life somewhat in the work that I do. But I mean, I think that's kind of the job of the composer, of the science fiction writer, of the storyteller, of whoever, to come up with narratives, alternative narratives to what we have at the moment, to be able to create alternative fantasies that we can kind of collectively strive toward.
You may have noticed I quite enjoy quotations, so I'm going to quote something to you which I think is apt for what you've just said, which is a wonderful line by Ursula Le Guin, where she said, "We live in capitalism. Its power seems inescapable. So did the divine right of kings. Any human power can be resisted and changed by human beings. Resistance and change often begin in art, very often in our art, the art of words, and of course we could say the art of notes." I'm wondering how you react to that, the very notion that another reality is indeed possible.
I very much believe that. I think that it's sometimes difficult to zoom out and see past it. I mean, that's why sometimes I like to read historical novels, or, you know, things that are written where the entire perspective and worldview was entirely different and felt at the time also fixed. I don't see our society, or even the human, what we define as a human, itself as something that's fixed. I think it's something that's malleable. And I think that's a really beautiful and hopeful thing.
I was fascinated that you interviewed Chelsea Manning, and I think about 5 years ago. And in a sense, WikiLeaks also confronts people with what I said before, with the repressed things we know about, but would rather act as if we didn't. Bring me back to that interview, if you could.
Oh, gosh, that was so long ago.
Only 5 years.
I know, but it's been a wild 5 years.
A wild 5 months.
A wild 5 months. I know, it feels like 50 years.
Doesn't it?
Well, that we had the opportunity to interview Chelsea while she was actually incarcerated, and so we had to communicate through her legal team. Mm. So we were able to submit a few questions, and that was in collaboration with Meta Haven and Jacob Applebaum, as well as a visual artist, Heather Dewey Hagborg, who took a kind of bio sample from Chelsea and was able to create a portrait of her. And so I can't remember exactly the questions that I submitted to her at the time, but I remember working on the questions, and it was a very emotional process, actually, just thinking about the incredible sacrifice that she was willing to make in the name of freedom of information, essentially. It felt like a huge opportunity to be able to speak with her, and also I just wanted to kind of show solidarity and support for what she was doing.
Baked into the logic of the internet is what you call a radical decontextualization, a disregard for where shit came from and who worked on it. How do you envision the future of copyright and ownership, not just for artists, but even for all of us?
Oh, this is maybe one of the biggest questions of the near-term future, especially regarding machine learning. We basically have to change our entire framework for how we think about this idea of sampling or copying or borrowing. I mean, the 20th century provided us with this framework with music concrète. You know, the Pierre Schaeffer, he liberated sound from its source. So we were able to kind of aestheticize the sound without thinking about where it was coming from. And this was thought of as a kind of liberatory listening, elevated listening experience. And it led to some amazing developments in music, such as hip hop and different forms of electronica, which I'm all very grateful for. That being said, they always say that it's the winners who write history. at the same time, so much of sampling culture was very exploitative. The man whose name is not coming to my mind at the moment, who wrote the Amen Break, which is the most sampled drum sound in history, basically was the basis for drum and bass music. He never knew, and he died homeless on the streets of Atlanta. So things like this are kind of like egregious examples of our past in dealing with things like sampling, you know, taking music from different cultures specifically out of context in a way that pleases our Western ears at times is sometimes extremely offensive and inappropriate. So we have this kind of entitled approach to sonic material from the 20th century that brought us wonderful music, but also brought us this quagmire of kind of disparity. And so now that we see machine learning on the horizon, it's here, and it's able to, it's almost like the next generation of sampler, where it can, anything that it listens to, it can kind of understand and then replicate in a way that's just different enough that it can kind of evade copyright. It isn't actually a sample of something, because it's kind of sculpting the sound from scratch, but just using the logic of the training data or the example. So this, I think it makes our 20th century approach to sampling culture untenable in the future, because it just kind of opens up a world where those with the, you know, with the most kind of GPU power will be able to kind of hoover up and reproduce all kind of cultural product without any repercussion. And that's not a world that I want to live in.
What's the world you would want to live in?
I want to live in a world where people aren't afraid to pay attribution and to say where their inspirations come from and to pay people for their ideas. And
what an idea.
Where they don't. I mean, I think it's actually quite possible.
In your recent work with AI, you were asking, what kinds of values do we want to instill at the protocol layer before things get out of hand? How would you answer your own question?
Well, I think just to kind of build on what we were just talking about, you know, if we look at the kind of way that the internet went, where you could kind of just copy, paste, and link to things without any kind of like back link, you know, it was only kind of a link forward architecture, you know, that decision had very wide spanning implications for how future use of the internet would occur. And so thinking about working with machine learning in a kind of similar way around attribution systems and kind of fair compensation for those whose labor goes into training models, I think those things should be built in from the start. And I think the start is now.
Yeah, this very moment.
Exactly. So when I see examples of people kind of sampling other people's personhood as a kind of machine learning research project, already a kind of red light flashes in my mind that we're seeing kind of sampling dynamics now being applied to people's personhood, to their very likeness, to their vocal likeness, to their visual likeness. And so I think, yeah, it just requires a kind of building whatever system we collectively come up with into the tech from the get-go.
This moment of the pandemic has been so troubling, and I think particularly troubling for musicians and actors, people who rely on an audience. And I'm wondering, as you think about it, when we go back to what passes for normal and hopefully with a difference, how do you think this moment in time will have perhaps changed our relationship to audiences?
It's funny, I was talking to Evgeny Morozov a couple months ago.
All right.
And I was asking him, you know, what does he think of of this moment, and he said that only a fool would comment on what this moment means, because we need more time to understand what it actually means. And I think he's really right there. But if I'm going to, I mean, I think people are really, or at least myself, I miss live congregation so much, and so much of what kind of immersive online platforms promised to kind of replace in-person congregation, it's not the same. It falls short. And so for my field, specifically music, I think it's just made people hungry for it to start up again. I don't think it will disappear. I think it's made us realize what the difference is between an online experience and an in-person experience. And it's made us hungry for it again. You know, a lot of people are doing kind of online concerts.
Yeah.
I understand that. People want to play, people want to communicate. I get that. But when you're performing music online, you're competing with movies, you're competing with, you know, immersive games. You're competing with that kind of like rectangular digital square. Whereas when you're giving a live performance in person, you know, you have the kind of sweaty experience of ecstasy with a kind of group of people who are all in it together. And that's what music has going for it. So I don't think that music can really compete in the same way through a streaming platform as it can in a real-time live situation. And so I think people that care deeply about music are really looking for that time to happen again.
You know, it's really disappointing to both watch the musicians perform online in that way, and also disappointing even when you have talks online, video talks. It just doesn't do it quite. And it reminds me of this wonderful comment by the English psychoanalyst Adam Phillips, who said, "We can't tickle ourselves." There's a disappointment inscribed in it, because we're tactile beings. We need to be in the presence of the other. Adam Phillips says this wonderful line. He says that we cannot tickle ourselves. You know, we need other people.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that's one reason why during this pandemic situation, I started doing a podcast as well.
Yes, yes. Tell us about it.
In terms of kind of broadcasting, podcasting has this intimacy that other media somehow doesn't contain. And I think it's just because it's often listened to on headphones. It's this kind of like intimate voice directly in your ear. It's, to me, kind of one of the closest things I can get to feeling like I'm in a room with a person. I actually prefer listening to podcasts more than I like watching video lectures.
Me too.
I feel like I'm separate from them.
Me too. That's why I didn't want to see you. I mean, there's an intimacy, and it's as if you're eavesdropping, and I'm particularly, you know, particularly wedded to the idea that the voice is so particular, and that the grain of the voice, as you have when you speak on the phone, is so particular. And it's so interesting to me that the phone, which used to be so prevalent, then became nearly out of use. And now again, because of this pandemic, the phone has become less exotic.
Yeah, it's funny about thinking about the telephone. You know, I wonder what it was like when it first came about, if people really felt like, wow, this is some sort of disembodied voice talking to me through a plastic object. It must have felt so alien and unnatural.
Yes.
And yet, I don't know, when I was a teenager, I would spend hours on the phone with like my ear glued to the phone, sweating, talking to my crush. And that felt like the most embodied kind of like, I don't know, intimate intertwining that I could have as a teenager.
Yeah, nearly better than the real thing.
Exactly. So it just shows how our relationships to technology can change and evolve over time.
Right, which brings us back to very much the kinds of conversation we're having. I will say that when the phone appeared, it wasn't plastic. So one wasn't putting a plastic object to one's ear. And Holly, since you're so interested, you were saying in historical fiction, actually, the birth of the telephone is beautifully written about. For instance, in Remembrance of Things Past of Proust, he talks about the beauty of calling someone up, much of the way I've done with you, and hearing the bells of the church nearby. I didn't hear the bells of the church, but I heard your dog. And it immediately brought me into your living room, as it were, imagining your surroundings.
Yeah, I guess it was metal and not plastic.
Yeah, it was metal. But I do so much remember my mother saying to me, "Paul, get off the phone." I would spend, hours and hours, she would say, "But you just saw this person in school. Why do you need to talk to them right away again? Please." Now, in closing, sadly, a question you're asking yourself is every gesture becoming part of a training canon for an unknown artificial intelligence? And I'm wondering if you have found an answer to that question.
I don't know of every single gesture, but certainly many gestures that we wouldn't think about are. So as soon as something can be captured in media, a photo, a video, audio recording, it can be used as a part of a training canon. So we could use this conversation and I could train a neural net on your voice, and then I could have you say whatever I wanted you to say.
Imagine that. And imagine that was I'm told that I have an accent, so imagine that.
I'm told that I have an accent too.
Yes. So
it only really flips out when I'm super tired. But yeah, I mean, imagine if all of this kind of training that we're doing, all of this work that we're doing, if we were able to all kind of benefit from some of the beautiful things that are built from that. That would be a really cool world.
Well, on that note of a cool world to come, Holly, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you. And I'll take a good listen to your podcast as well.
Thanks. This was nice. Have a nice day.
You do too. All the very best in Berlin. Stay safe, stay well, and perhaps one day our paths will cross.
Please do.
Bye-bye.
Please come through.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
To support this show and DubLab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.